You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
All right, take two. Melody, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, like I said, it's timely talking to you. Somebody settling on a house next week may not be the best market to do it, but I got to get my forever house. And for anybody who didn't catch the first interview with Melody in Q3, beginning of Q4 last year, just a little background. Melody's a housing market analyst and independent researcher. She's based in Tennessee. She runs the M3_Melody Substack, which is great. I highly recommend subscribing to it if you want to stay up to date on this. She's doing deep dive analysis on housing data, labor markets, and the intersection of government policy with real estate. Former mortgage industry professional who now does investigative field reporting, literally visiting homeless camps, detention centers, and distressed neighborhoods to ground truth the data she studies, collaborating with other researchers and getting data from Fred, NAR, census, and county level records. And like I said, I think your most recent newsletter that you dropped last week talking about home sales in December, the retail sort of credit situation and the stress the consumer is under is something that many people are not aware of because we're being told that the economy is running hot. It's the best economy ever. But if you look under the hood, things are not all well from your perspective. So what are you seeing out there, Melody?
Yeah, no, I think you summed it up nicely. I mean, you know, we've been seeing this this under the covers trouble for some time, especially in what I'll call government subprime FHA. You know, when those student loans started reporting to credit again, it really impacted a lot of the people who should be forming households. And so you had people going from 750 credit scores to 550. And so very quickly, you know, credit got cut off. At the same time, you know, in the mortgage market specifically, guardrails went on the FHA program, which were being taken advantage of. A lot of fraudsters were taking advantage of it, but essentially you could just keep not paying over and over and you would go get another workout and another workout. And so guardrails went on that program. So you could, when we look at stuff in the aggregate, Marty, I think this is where everybody, you know, can have that false sense of calm because it looks okay. Like, oh, you know, home equity, that looks like that's great. Not unlike the last time people will often say, but there's so much going on that's new that people don't understand. Like, today, for instance, Klarna reported, right? And they had a loss and they are very much, some of the people that use Klarna, buy now, pay later, are the exact people that would be, that we would hope would be out there buying homes. But unfortunately, they have to, you know, basically finance their burritos. And so, you know, you look at the youth unemployment rate. I mean, so I guess in there are so many things, so much weakness under the surface that almost no one is paying attention to. And so in all pockets of the market, be it in mortgage, where you're starting to see delinquency rise, and we're going to see that from here, you're actually starting to see the prime books get impacted. And they always come after the subprime, you know, when the layoffs happen. And the issue now is, a lot of this lending was made on inflated credit scores and that did not include, you know, the student loans and things like that, or, you know, those eviction moratoriums. And now those inflated credit scores are coming down with student loans reporting. So it's just a much murkier picture than what people, and I don't know how anyone can say anything positive. I mean, existing home sales last year were the worst since 1995, and we've increased population by over 20%. I mean, so, you know, this market is completely frozen. You had a lot of rage delisters last year that couldn't get the price they wanted, and so they just took it off the market. But what you've seen since the recent Bitcoin route, kind of what happened there and the wobbliness in the stock market, is inventory is flying to the markets. It had been coming off, but now it's flying on non-seasonally. This isn't the time of year you would typically your inventory bottoms in February. So.
Well, I thought it was interesting that you covered the Bitcoin price drop in gold and silver in this newsletter, because I'm not sure if you caught on to this meme, but I think Bitcoin is a leading indicator of liquidity, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
It trades 24/7, 365. It's very easy to sell and get cash. And so if a liquidity crisis is pending, it's one of the first assets to go. And so that's what we've been talking about in the Bitcoin space with this price drop of 36%, 48% since the highs of late October, early November last year, is that something's got to be wonky in the back of the system from a liquidity perspective. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of the data that you highlighted in your newsletter last week points to this. I mean, looking at credit card spending in December alone, looks right. like people were tapped out of cash and really right. pulling out the plastic to do their spending around Christmas time. And then I think it would also be important to really dive into the new home listings and home sales in December, because those are some pretty historic lows in terms of what's coming to market, what's actually being sold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So specifically on the new home side, we're going to get results tomorrow for both November and December. And we, you know, we've been going off, we only got October because Census is the one who prepares that. But on the existing home side, I mean, yes, a lot of people wanted to blame the storm, Marty, but California is our biggest housing market out there. And the storm came very late in the month. It was just, I mean, these were just really bad sales, like worse than January 2007, worse than January 2008. And, you know, again, the population is much higher. I think there's some things going on, though, that a lot of people don't understand, which is I think that the National Association of Realtors, these listing sites, the MLS, they're losing relevance. And so I think that we're actually having, there are quite a few transactions that aren't being captured in their statistics, because you had a lot of people, they did this back in the 80s too, when rates rose, is you had a lot of seller financing because, you know, people couldn't get approved at the higher interest rates. And so the seller would say, I'll finance this for you. Those and selling homes. So some of the transactions are just not being captured, a lot of them by the investors as well. And so, you know, we're just, the housing market has always taken it. The indicators are very lagged. The data is not real time because a lot of it to really get accuracy is pulled from county records. And that can be, there's over 3,000 counties in the country. And some of them, believe it or not, are not on any kind of e-record platform. They're still mailing stuff in. So, you know, I just say that because although sales are horrible, I mean, they're just absolutely horrible, I think we are missing a component of the housing market right now with these private note actors that are out there transacting not on the MLS. So I just kind of wanted to state that because I think people are going to be surprised when they realize how much inventory is out there. And because I talk to them all the time, they say, well, look at what was on the MLS in 2008. There were 4 million homes and now we only have 1 million. And I'm like, yeah, but there have been studies that 50% of transactions aren't, like, let's say in Austin, weren't handled through the MLS. So we're just, it's a very murky, muddy picture that hopefully I haven't lost everyone in those details. But what we are starting to see is median listing price. So that's the idea of the median of whatever the listing price was, that has now come in negative year over year for 2 months in a row. It's now under 400,000 for the first time since 2022. You know, while the builders, on the other hand, for their prices, they have been selling under the existing home price for almost a full year. In the last cycle, we saw that one month in June, I think, of 2006. And so you've got these crazy fundamentals where the new homes are selling below 400,000, a median price. And then that's not even including the 50,000 of incentives they're putting on top of that. And so we just got builder sentiment and it went down again as well. So I'm really looking forward to new home sale results tomorrow because it'll give me a clearer picture. But at this moment, last year was the worst we've had in, you know, over 30 years, which is insane.
Yeah, just anecdotally to confirm one of your theses there. I mean, the house that I'm buying, we did it off market, so it didn't hit. We're in a neighborhood where you have a bunch of aging out boomers who want to hand it off to younger families. And so we're able to do that transaction directly. And I think there's a lot of that going on, at least where I am.
I do too. And then, you know, if you're not pulling from public record, then no one really knows what the median price is out there. You know, if homes aren't selling that are, you know, or they're selling but not being captured in the MLS, then we really have no idea what is going on out there. But what you can get a sense of, you know, because I track 85 markets, is there's price cuts everywhere. They're just not selling those houses. They're just continuing to do price cuts. And so it's going to be one of those gradually then suddenly things, you know, when you actually can get someone in the market to buy. But that's the thing. There's just nobody left to buy. And the institutionals are not interested at these price levels.
Well, this comes back to something else you covered in last week's newsletter, which is non-farm payrolls and the revisions. And I think that's one thing that always makes me chuckle is you get the headline number and then 9 months, a year later, you get the revisions and nothing's as rosy as it was originally reported.
No, and that just seems to be happening on every front, right? And so I think, you know, just take the new home sales price for a minute. They shaved almost, they revised 5 years of history through the COVID and shaved $30,000 off of the new home price high, okay, peak. It was at 496. They revised and said, no, then they didn't tell us why. They didn't really tell us why. But now it was at the peak was 460,000 on the new homes. And just 5 years of what we thought was reality just got wiped out. And so that's the limitation, I think, of the data. And that's why I think you have to go look for yourself. And you also have to, you know, track non-traditional metrics because we're not getting the full picture out there in any way.
Yeah. Well, sticking on the jobs market, too. I mean, you highlight that. There's a bit of a jobs mirage with education and health services carrying the entire labor market. And right. We've come to find with health services specifically, it's a lot of that's driven by overt fraud.
Exactly. That's where a lot of those Somalis jobs were, you know, that's where they sit. And so what happened after the American Rescue Plan is all this money went out to the municipalities and they created all these programs like housing affordable, daycare programs, whatever. And they employed a lot of people, theoretically, although I think a lot of it was fraud. And so that's why you've seen that job growth. But what's happening now, Marty, is these municipalities have run out of money and it's not coming. I mean, California is a great example of they are in so much trouble. Chicago, another example, they don't have any more money to fund these programs and they're not going to get it from federal. They might get a little, but they're not going to get enough to sustain them. And so, you know, we're looking at a bunch of municipalities in crisis, which will impact those education and health services jobs, which is the only jobs that were created last year, really.
Yeah. And if you're not getting a health service or education job, you're getting a second job, which is.
Well, right. Right.
You know, that's the highest percent of workers holding two part-time jobs ever.
Yep.
Right now?
Yes, ever. In the series, since I think it goes back to the 60s. So yeah, that's nuts. It's so two part-time jobs just to make ends meet. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah. And then, I mean, we don't want to be too dimmerish here, but we're trying to distill exactly what's going on. You also mentioned like private credit in last week's newsletter. And that was actually, funnily enough, the FOMC meeting minutes from last month came out earlier this week and private credit was an area that the board highlighted as something to pay attention to and that is worrying them.
And this is another thing that's not tracked in this space. Like, so what, you know, you have your old traditional hard money lenders, which would like, you don't, it's like a personal loan. But they were they were usually regional, and they would make you pay a huge down payment or an exorbitant interest rate to kind of cover their risk. What private credit did is they came in and what they thought their sophisticated underwriting models, they weren't that sophisticated. They just went off the credit score, basically. And so I've talked to people in this space that are freaking out because they know those credit scores were inflated. I mean, look at Klarna today. Like that is, we knew this was coming because we knew that the numbers they were reporting for delinquency did not add up. But yeah. And so you've got a ton of private credit out there, and the banks have lent to, you know, people like Tricolor and those actors who have gone out and lent money, and they're not recording deeds. So we don't know if there's money lent against the house. And they're also, many of them aren't reporting to credit, you know? And so it's just a big, and we know that the shadow market is about 2.5 times bigger than it was during the last crisis.
Yeah. And I saw a headline yesterday about subprime auto loan delinquency rates skyrocketing. And obviously, yeah, 90 plus day delinquency rates on real estate are rising as well. And I'm just wondering how much of that is due to the immigration policy of the last year, and like how many immigrants that were here illegally but were able to get FHA loans and subprime auto loans simply had to leave the country, which is driving that up. But regardless, there's still
no one can really track that. I've been trying to get good data on that, but there's just not really good data.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about the 90 plus day delinquency rates mm-hmm. in real estate specifically, and there's some sort of foreclosure game going on.
Oh, the sub two. mm-hmm. I'll talk about what's going on in delinquency. Basically, when the guardrails went on that FHA loss mitigation program, which was just basically an open till to whoever wanted to come take advantage of it, that meant that we were going to see serious delinquency increase because they are no longer eligible for some of these workouts, or they have to do things like make a trial payment. So let me give you, I have one borrower in one of my client books who went back 6 times and has been delinquent for the past 2 years, but nowhere near foreclosure yet, Marty. And so, you know, because all that government intervention and workout. And so that's all finally running out, believe it or not, and will run out over the next 12 months. And so that serious delinquency is going to go up. It will get a little bit of improvement. We always do in the spring with bonus payouts and tax refunds and things like that. What'll be interesting to track is how much. And because like for auto, it didn't help last year. So we'll be watching all of that. But what you were talking about, so this is something the mortgage industry has no idea is going on. It's called sub two, or subject to mortgages. And what these investors did is they would, when you are in default, the servicer has to record something called a notice of default or a list pendants saying that you're about to be, a complaint will be filed against you. So the investors will go research those, and then they'll go contact you and they'll say, hey, listen, I got a deal for you. I could take over your mortgage payments for you. If you sell me this house, and I could maybe give you an equity sweetener, or you could rent from me for a little while. And this investor is trying to find someone, while they're doing all that, they're trying to find someone to buy the home from them. What's happening now, initially, these investors would record those deeds, but there's this thing called a due on sale clause that if you sell your home, your note becomes immediately due and owing. So what's happening now is these investors, as I knew they would, because they always do, they walked away. And now the borrower is on the hook because they're still on the note. And so they're being, you know, foreclosure proceedings are going against them. They may not even be living in the house anymore, Marty. But this is a huge it's part of that private note shadow market that I was talking about. And I think this is one of the things that's kept delinquency lower. But people can no longer, when home prices aren't appreciating, you cannot get a buyer to come in and just, you know, pay ridiculous money for that house anymore. And so they're walking away. They can't make the payments. So there's just a ton of stuff going on in this market.
And that's sub two, Kyrie. The investors are walking away because they don't have the cash, or are they just saying, hey, this isn't worth it? And
yeah, it's not worth it, or they don't have the cash.
So freaks, if you've been listening for a while, you've probably heard us all talk about BitKey. It's a Bitcoin wallet built for people who want self-custody to actually fit into their lives. BitKey is a private multi-sig wallet that removes the biggest point of failure in traditional self-custody, the seed phrase. No ceremony, nothing to hide, and no single mistake that can put your Bitcoin at risk. We all know, things get lost. I lose things all the time. Phones get replaced. Life happens. BitKey specifically is designed so your Bitcoin stays secure and recoverable without demanding constant attention or expertise. Because it's built for the long term, inheritance is built in, so your Bitcoin can move securely into the next generation. It's Bitcoin self-custody built for real life, and for February only, for you freaks, okay? February only, you got 28 days, not a leap year, I'm pretty sure, 28 days. You listeners, TFTC listeners, can get BitKey for $99 using code TFTC99 at bitkey.world. That's bitkey.world. Use the code TFTC99, and you're going to get a BitKey for $99.
So, freaks, when you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. And it always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
I mean, for the private credit specifically, whether it's hard money lenders, these sub two investors, and you get like commercial real estate, it's got to be, again, the Fed calling it out.
Yeah.
Last month, or the FOMC, it's becoming abundantly clear that private credit is in trouble. And we had, what was it, Blue Owl last night?
Yeah, Blue Owl.
Stop redemptions on one of their retail oriented private equity funds. It seems like all the cash that was printed and flushed into the economy in 2020, it's not getting the return that those investors hoped it would.
No. And, you know, especially there's so much private credit and real estate, you know, like 20 to 25% of the loans in private credit, I mean, of commercial real estate are private credit loans. And I mean, so yeah, this is a dumpster fire, and it's, you know, and I guarantee you that a lot of the people that are at these firms know how much trouble they're in, but they're not telling anybody, you know. It takes a long time, as we can see. I mean, Blackstone, for instance, is in a ton of trouble. And, you know, and it's, but they can keep up appearances, but they're running out of time. They're losing enough on the commercial real estate. They're losing enough on their single family rental business that I think we're going to start seeing impacts in Breit, for instance. You know, we'll hear about them gating redemptions again as well. Probably in the near future.
That's been one of my sort of tinfoil hat theories with Trump announcing that these investors can't buy single family homes anymore. And his $200 billion mortgage buying facility. I don't know if it officially launched, but he announced it. And particularly,
they had already been doing it. They'd already been buying the MBS.
Yeah, particularly with the former, though, is like, is it just a sly bailout? You're going to say they can't buy
them. Oh, it's a total bailout. Yeah, that's a, it's a bailout for them. Because I was in the room with one of them in September, and he's like, we've been chasing price for a year. You know, they don't get a homestead exemption, so their taxes are much higher. Their insurance is higher. And so they can't, they are, as soon as these long-term rentals, the leases expires, they're rehabbing them and selling them, and which is why you're seeing price declines in places like San Antonio and Atlanta and Tampa, because you have very large institutional presences in those cities.
So
it's a bailout, Marty. I mean, I guarantee you this is phase one. Oh, you can't buy these homes anymore. Phase two is like, hey, you know, we'll give you a deal if you sell these homes, you know, through one of our affordable housing programs.
Well, that's what I was saying. Maybe they have like a BTFP, BTFB facility. They're going to say, hey, yeah, we'll buy these assets at par for
100%.
You.
100%. I bet we'll get there.
Yeah. And so where do you think the sort of rubber meets the road and this becomes obvious to the market?
Oh, I don't know. You know, the fact that we're in an election year, like, you know, I think that there is like, it's accumulating the awareness. Like, you know, it's no longer just Florida and Texas. Like California is on the board. Like it is on the board. You're starting to see a deceleration in the Midwest and Northeast on their home prices. And I think pretty soon the Midwest will turn because they investors descended on them because they were the last place you could get a decently priced single family home. But I think it's going to take till the Northeast has some sort of awareness for there to be national awareness. And the Northeast has a ton of problems around their demographics. And, you know, those census updates are huge, showing everybody they didn't quite get the population gain that they thought. And, you know, the Northeast, very low owner occupancy, which means you got a lot of mom and pop investors, most of which are boomers who are aging out and will be. What's really interesting, Marty, I'm seeing in the cities I track is that the rate of folks who are deceased property owners, like, so you can track who's deceased, is, I mean, in some cities up 25% year over year. And so, you know, this is going, and Charles Schwab did a study and said 70% of the time, people who inherit property sell them. And so all these things take a little bit of time. It takes time to get through probate. But I think the demographics are going to really start to become obvious in places like the Northeast and Boston, and actually Philly and Pittsburgh both have been showing price weakness. And so, but I think until the Northeast falls, there probably won't be large scale awareness. But with the price cuts I'm seeing, you know, once we can get activity in the market, we are definitely going to see that suddenly, you know, hit the gradually, then suddenly. We could skate for another selling season based on, you know, hopium and promises. But I have a feeling we're going to see some disorder in this selling season, especially in places like Texas and California.
Do you think this is necessary?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, if they'll let it happen, they're going to try everything, but everything, there's a point where everything doesn't work anymore. You know, like everything they've tried, like I love to talk about, they bought mortgage-backed securities back, you know, in 2009 and, you know, prices just kept plummeting and it didn't do anything. Like it created a little refi boomlet in 2010. But now we've got people like the Fed reported over 43% mortgage refi rejections. And so people can't even, you know, they can't qualify for a refinance. That's the highest in their series, you know? So it's just a slow burn that it's gaining speed and gaining traction. But if we could get transactions, we would see true price discovery. And yes, it's absolutely necessary because, you know, household median income is not even in the same ballpark as, you know, median homes prices. And so who's going to buy these? It's not going to be the institutionals. It's not going to be your cohorts coming of age. I mean, the unemployment rate in the 18 to 24 is insane. So we're not going to form households until the affordability problem is fixed. And so, yeah, I think this is necessary.
Yeah, then you have the AI boom happening, which is telling the Gen Z and Gen Alpha don't even try to get a job.
Right. Right. As if their lives couldn't be more depressing. You know, like it's kind of, yeah, it's really not good for that cohort right now.
No. Well, you have the whole K-shaped economy meme becoming more prominent. I think it's becoming more confirmed. It is. It's not easy out there. Particularly for the younger generations. And again, going back to the demographics and push coming to shove with boomers aging out and just factually dying out as well. Like right. the flood of supply that just, if you're just looking at the math, that is due to hit the market is going to be pretty significant. And this goes back, I mean, this is something I've always been curious about with new home builds too, when you consider the quality of new builds right. compared to older builds, particularly if they're built like 50 years mm-hmm. or longer ago, they're actually sturdier. Like the house we're buying is very old, and I feel more comfortable in that than some of the new builds coming up. And this whole supply meme that's been going out there, you have podcasters like the All In guys and the president in this administration saying we just need more supply to bring prices down. I don't think that's the case. And on top of that, the new supply is not a quality build at the end of the day.
No, because who was building it? And, you know, it was subcontractors, but they were illegal immigrants. That's who. And often I on these new build sites, Marty, it's a little scary. Like you're seeing, like we did one video where we just went around, got the Jack Daniels bottle, the Modelo cases, empty cases, like the empty beer bottles that were just all over. I think it was Lennar job site. And so, you know, the quality is horrendous. There just wasn't, I mean, all these thousands of new home communities I went to, you didn't have, these did not look like professionals building these homes.
Yeah.
And nor were they managed by professionals on site.
So. Yeah, so how much of like the lack of new home sales is being driven by people looking at these, being like, I'm not buying this paper mache box.
Right.
And then what is
I think that's part of it.
What is the exposure to these?
Yeah. And not only that, they built luxury. It's like, who are you building for? Like, you know, I know in 21 we saw wages rise, but not like something crazy. But that's what happened is all the builders went out there and built for the Californian and New Yorker that was coming to their town. And built luxury apartments and all luxury homes, like these gigantic, some of the spec homes I've seen out there just blow my mind. Like $13 million spec house, $25 million spec house, meaning they didn't have a buyer. They just built that house. And it's like this massive luxury structure that you can go in all the 85 markets I track and you can see this luxury sitting empty. There are not enough people to buy those homes. And so I think you're going to have, there's going to be a lot of bulldozing when people really finally start to deal with the problem. But we're far from that right now, unfortunately. Like people are still believing that it's an inventory shortage.
We talked about this last time around, but when I was in Austin, there was one of these luxury builds around the corner from us. We moved in 2021, it finished construction, I believe, at the beginning of 2022, and we left June of last year, was still sitting there up for sale.
Yeah. And what's crazy is a lot of these cities are still building them, like Phoenix. I'm just like, you people are nuts. I mean, and they're everywhere. And it's so weird. It's like these developers, they never just drive around the town. They never just even go two blocks over. Like Nashville is another good example. If and when you go back, like there's attached to downtown is just like apartment on top of apartment. I mean, if 50% of those apartments, and they're all new, were filled, you would never be able to leave your house because the traffic would be so bad, the congestion, because they just built all these things on top of one another with no parking. And that's the really sad thing about a lot of this is that people just, you know, set new builds down in cow pastures, wherever they could find, you know, they could build, and they didn't think about infrastructure. And so, you know, and I've seen some really sad small towns be destroyed across the country due to like, okay, you're outside of Raleigh. Oh, that's going to be the new Apple headquarters. Oh, no, not so much. Maybe not, you know, or whatever. and so they went to these little towns and just like destroyed them. They like bought up all these older homes and fixed and flipped them or just, you know, put those new build communities, but there's no way to get in and out of these towns. Like it's all, you know, two lane. It's so sad.
Very high time preference. Describe it as the high velocity trash economy where you're just building to build to hit your,
absolutely.
Your quarterly marks. What do you think the knock on effects of all this will be?
Well, we're going to see crime increase That's an effect, because the vacancy out there is a massive problem that nobody's talking about. And, you know, it's only a matter of time when all the homeless in Austin figure out, you know, 10 miles south, there's an empty new build that nobody's policing. It's like, why don't we just go set up shop down there? You know, but I think you're seeing it already in cities like Dallas, in the downtowns. They're terrifying. I wrote an article for Unica's research last week, which was called Creepy Is Not Cool, because these downtowns are creepy. I mean, they're just creepy. You don't want to be in them, which means they're never going to be able to get, you know, they're not going to be able to attract new business down there either. And so I think you're going to have an increase in crime. You know, we're already seeing an increase in homelessness. But later down the line, if you're not in debt, and this is really important, don't get into stupid debt. And you have a job, like you have a job, maybe you're a plumber, maybe you know, instead of going to school, you went and did a trade. Then you're going to be in a good position to get a home. And so that's the long, you know, after a few years, that's the effect. And in some of these markets, it'll be before then, as well. But yeah. I mean, we're looking at, I think we're going to be looking at a lot of municipalities like filing bankruptcy. And I think they'll probably be begging for help from the federal government to deal with these vacant homes. And because a lot of these homes were bought with all cash during this last cycle, which means they're not sitting on a bank's balance sheet, which means the grass isn't getting cut. The pipes aren't getting winterized. The mold's not getting removed. So that means all kinds of issues. I mean, I saw it when I managed a fault during the last crisis. I mean, these homes get into the worst shape, and you almost can't even recover them because, you know, they're just in such a state of disrepair.
Yeah. When you say downtown Dallas is great, like, so what do you mean specifically? What are some examples?
What's crazy about Dallas, is they've got these massive, you know, high rises, commercial real estate, completely empty. And on the back of it, you see a stroller and evidence of homeless that have been living there. And then right next door, they have this massive high rise that's being completed, office building. But if you walk in downtown Dallas, like it's a ghost town. It's a ghost town. And it's creepy because you're walking around. You know, you're seeing these what looks like homeless camps in downtown Dallas. So, you know, it's every, like San Antonio, you know, a very similar situation. When I was in San Antonio, I saw somebody OD right in front of us. Like we were in the truck, like filming downtown right next to us, just OD. I mean, it feels as if most people haven't been to their downtown in a very long time because they just are unaware with how creepy these places have become because they're just empty.
Sup, freaks? This rip is brought to you by good friends at Silent. Silent creates everyday Faraday gear that protects your hardware. We're in Bitcoin. We have a lot of hardware that we need to secure. Your wallet emits signals that can leave you vulnerable. You want to pick up Silent's gear, put your hardware in that. I have a tap signer right here. I got the Silent card holder, replaced my wallet. I was using Ridge Wallet because it's secured against RFID signal jacking. Silent, the card holder, does the same thing. It's much sleeker, fits in my pocket much easier. I also have the Faraday phone sleeve, which you can put a hardware wallet in. We're actually using it for our keys at the house, too. There's been a lot of robberies. They have essential Faraday slings, Faraday backpacks. It's a Bitcoin company. They're running on a Bitcoin standard. They have a Bitcoin treasury. They accept Bitcoin via Strike. So go to slnt.com/TFTC. to get 15% off anything, or simply just use the code TFTC when shopping at slnt.com. Patented technology, special operations approved. It has free shipping as well, so go check it out.
Sup, freaks? This rip was brought to you by our good friends at Ligos Finance, Celsius, BlockFi, FTX. They took your Bitcoin and gambled it away. Ligos can't because they never hold it. Non-custodial lending on Bitcoin's base layer. Your keys, your collateral. It's verifiable on-chain. Go to ligos.finance. Tell them that TFTC sent you.
Do you think despite the repositioning by this administration that everything's all good, economy's hot, they understand these problems exist, and they're just, I think you described the saber rattling between President Trump and the Federal Reserve as KFOB Do you think similarly the projection of everything is all well and great is KFOB too, and they know things are not all well under the hood, and they're just trying to narrative craft until they can find an excuse to actually flood the system with more liquidity?
Yeah. So, this is a question I obsess over. I can't, it's like they have to know some of it. But I have a feeling they don't know all of it, because I talk to people in government now and about their cities and say, did you know this? Do you know that? They don't know, because that's what's happening now, is I'm getting contacted by more policy focused people who want to talk to me about maybe solutions. Finally, that's happening. But they aren't aware of how much inventory they have. And in places like Texas and in some unincorporated areas across the country, you didn't even have to file permits. And so a lot of the local leaders don't even know. And so I think it's funny, like Pulte followed me for years before he got, and, he would share my stuff. And all I ever do is talk about the inventory shortage myth. And, but the day one into the administration, he, sang a different tune. And I actually know the CFO of Freddie. He was one of the last people standing, because they went in and gutted the executives at Freddie. I mean, he was my boss during the GFC for a certain, he has to know. I haven't spoken to him, but there are just so many clear telltale signs if you are in the know. And so it's weird in mortgage specifically. Like, people who originate the loans never talk to people who service the loans. And so the originators never realize what's happening on the back end. And so I think we're still in that part of the cycle where the origination narrative is kind of driving the narrative. But in servicing, when I talk to the big servicers, they know what's happening. So I think it's probably a combination of they know, but they don't know the scale. But if it were me, and I would never do this, I don't want to be a politician, but if I were a politician, I would do probably what they were doing. Like, just say whatever. Like, what is it? He's speaking to whatever interest group in that moment, but you have to look at what the policy is. And when they put those guardrails on FHA, that was a real action, and that's going to have real consequences. And they have to know that delinquency on FHA is unbelievable. And so there have got to be people on that side of the house that understand that this is really, really bad.
Yeah. Is there anything similar going on to, like, sort of just vanilla bank loans? I've been reading Bill Moreland's bank reg data, and he was saying that they're just disguising sort of their exposure to these delinquent loans by some sort of 12-month window that they're able to push it off the balance sheet. And it looks like it's better than it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah. And Fannie and Freddie and FHA hasn't done as much of this recently, but they do these things called non-performing loan sales. And so they'll literally take their delinquent book and sell it and then turn around to you and say, hey, our delinquency is only 0.67%. Well, where'd those loans go? Okay, well, they went to private hedge funds who then turn around and sell it to individuals who don't report to credit. And so, we just don't have a very clear view of what's really. But yes, I try to help people understand that what they did is, instead of waiting for the crisis, they took the old loss mitigation programs from the GFC and they put them on steroids, and they took away all the requirements and things you had to do. Because back then you had to virtually re-underwrite the loan. Well, they said, you don't have to do that anymore. You don't even have to ask for their financials. I mean, this is crazy, Marty. I mean, that's crazy. Like, you don't even want to know if they can pay. Like, what? Like, why would you? It's all a game of extend and pretend. And so we've had, if you think about it, we've had enough, like the same amount of workouts that we had after the last cycle times about two or three. And that's what's kept us skating for this long. And now that stuff's running out. So it's just like what Bill talks about.
Yeah. And it's funny, too. I mean, talking about extend and pretend. And I don't know if this went anywhere, but you're mentioning Bill Pulte, the 50-year mortgage that was floated in December. What was your reaction to that? Because we haven't spoken before.
I was furious. Yeah, I didn't want to talk about it, but like literally everybody, I got so blown up. I mean, my life went crazy for a couple of weeks, but I was just like, this is so stupid. I can't even talk about it because, you know, by year 11, if anyone in this country like knew what an amortization schedule actually looked like, they would not borrow money. I mean, but we're not taught that in school. But by year 11 of that loan, you would have paid $270,000 in interest. That is what a median home price should be. Our median home prices should be around that 250 mark, you know? And so that's just nuts. That's nuts, you know? And it's just debt slavery. It's just another form of debt slavery. And believe it or not, they had them back during the last crisis as well. Like some people did. You can do them in California. And they're doing what's called a 40-year modification right now. And it's not helping anybody because basically your payment goes down by like $20 and then you add 10 more years to your loan. I mean, I just hope people understand, please don't do this. Like, just please. It's just, you're going to be a slave forever.
Well, you see this extend and pretend, not only the 50-year mortgage, but I'm not sure if you caught Google wanted to issue a 100-year bond.
Yeah.
To fund their,
I did.
To fund their data center expansion. And people look at that like, oh, look, long-term financing. It's like, no, that's, we need to get suckers at the table to give us cash so we can do this and push our payments out a century.
Yeah. It's just so nuts. Some of the things you see going on right now just make your head hurt. I mean, you know, but a lot of it is just, you know, it's just a lot of delusion still.
Well, what are your thoughts on this data center expansion? How does it affect, I guess, commercial real estate?
Yeah, I mean, industrial is already... their vacancy is increasing. I mean, what I saw across the country was a lot of new data centers for sale and for lease. And, you know, although I forget how to say his name, Torsten Slock or whatever from Apollo, like he has this chart out there that shows that kind of data center construction peaked in 2023. So, I mean, Marty, I think we might be at a point where like it's already happened. We're just not aware. Like the slowdown is already happening, even though they're all out there talking about building, you know, data centers on the moon and blah, 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 blah. I think that's just the somebody give us some money for ridiculous idea kind of thing. But I think that so two things. One, social media use peaked in 2022. You know, I think the numbers from OpenAI, you know, they're going down. Like I think this is all peaked already and we're still dealing with, you know, kind of the delusion. And then the second thing that's going on is, you know, the public is they're pushing back on this massively all over the country. Moratoriums, people showing up furious at city council meetings because their electricity bills are going up. And this is, I mean, you know, DeSantis has gotten on this early, and then Bernie Sanders kind of got in, and now the Democrats are, this is going to be a huge midterm issue, in my opinion. And so I think we're not going to have all that construction. I think that we're just still running through the mania mode right now. But that in reality, I think they all know that doesn't even make any sense. We should be focused on if we believe, in this technology, we should be focused on how to scale it, you know, like how to get the kind of power that wouldn't just take down the entire grid or whatever. But I have a conspiracy theory on this one that I actually believe a lot of what was written into the BBB is about fortifying the grid versus, you know, maybe construction because, I mean, construction for a private sector, because I, you know, remember when they did that big infrastructure bill during COVID, like what happened? Like nothing, you know? And it's like our grid is not in good shape. And so I don't know if you saw the tweet by Trump before the storms that he was going to tap data centers for power to shore up the grid. And I think that some of this might actually be a way to sell infrastructure improvements wrapped in an AI mania narrative.
I actually wouldn't be mad at that. Like, I think it's critically necessary. We need energy generation capacity expansion. We need transmission expansion. To your point, the grid is not in a great spot right now. It could certainly be better. And we've seen this in Bitcoin. Like, I've been in Bitcoin mining for almost a decade now. And that's one thing we do very well is demand response. And so, like, in ERCOT, the TVA, where you are, and mining operations that were in certain price programs that we get a good deal, because this happened 3 weeks ago when the storm hit, when demand spikes, like, we get asked to shut down. We're able to send that electricity back to residential consumers.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. I mean, you know,
but that's specific to Bitcoin. You can do that with Bitcoin miners because Bitcoin is a distributed system. And so shutting down mining operations in Tennessee because it's cold doesn't disrupt the Bitcoin network. It may slow down block production by a few seconds to a few minutes, but that's not going to stop transactions from ultimately being processed. And so you have a unique use case within Bitcoin mining where you have this sort of responsive, controllable load that can turn off in a moment's notice. But when it comes to the AI, particularly if you're training models and running inference, like, those operations can't be disrupted. Bitcoin is called disruptible load. That exists. And so, like, if we are going to build out these data centers and this infrastructure, like, I think the Bitcoin mines need to be, or the AI data centers need to be paired with Bitcoin mines that provide that disruptible load to send electricity back to residents when they need it, when demand spikes.
Right. Yeah. And I'm actually going to be doing a trip here soon to Stargate and a bunch of the different data centers in the South. Because I want to see what's really going on there. We can't trust what we're being told. My conclusion, and the way that I really understand what was happening in housing, was I went out and looked. And so that's what we're going to do, is go look at some of these big sites and see, you know, the ones in Memphis. That's going to be a very interesting case. It looks, they're getting sued. I just think there's going to be a ton of pushback on these. I saw Ed Dowd tweet something funny that I actually believe in, that I think what they're doing is spurring this anti-technology movement. Like, people are saying, I mean, I don't want smart technology in my house. I don't want to be woken up in the middle of the night when Amazon AWS goes down and my bed, like, bolts me out of bed by raising up, or suddenly it's 150 degrees in my bed. Like, and these are the types of things that, you know, we don't need that. That's just stupid. Like, what does that do? And then, you know, these appliances that they're all smart, they die in like 2 years, the software dies, like, whatever. Yeah. And, you know, so there's no quality. So I think actually what we're probably going to see is kind of the rise of a, I don't want this stuff, you know. There's
a bunch of Uncle Ted acolytes coming out of the woodwork to say, hey.
Right.
I'm very big anti smart home guy. But again, So I've been using AI at TFTC to help just automate some stuff on the back end. It's been extremely helpful. But to your point, it's sort of threading the needle and figuring out what the appropriate trade-offs are, like, how to use this appropriately. And then I'm sure you saw yesterday that sort of white hat hacker research group found out that the company doing KYC AML for OpenAI is just automatically piping all the information to the government. And you have this surveillance panopticon that is being erected behind the scenes alongside this AI technology. And
yeah,
there's a right way and a wrong way to do everything, including AI. All layers of it, from the energy, like, to the data center discussion and the pushback against it. Like, we've learned this in Bitcoin mining too, and I think Bitcoin miners actually have it worse because the machines create so much noise. You have to be very specific with where you plot these data centers down. Right. They should be like in rural areas where you're not going to disrupt residential neighborhoods because the sound's too loud or it's just ugly and eyesore. I saw earlier this morning at New Brunswick, I'm not sure which state, the citizens there were successfully able to convince their city council that to deny a data center district. Construction. Yeah. But the point being is like there's trade-offs, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. I think AI is figuring that out. Bitcoin miners figured it out beginning of 2020, 2021. You got to be very strategic where you plop these down. And
absolutely.
Unfortunately, due to the state of the grid and generation capacity, your options are limited. But I think we need to get to the base of this industry, which is generation capacity, and smartly plop down generation in areas where it's not going to disrupt residential consumers.
Yeah, I wish we were having conversations about what we want this to be. You know, it just, it feels like it's so much hype. There's not really any like, okay, what do we really want here? And, you know, there, the technoculta group, the technocracy, but I put cult in the middle of it. You know, they have very things that I don't think any of us really know and understand as their end goals. You know, like the vitalism movement or whatever.
Transhumanism.
Transhumanism. We, you know, our biggest problem is that we die, you know, these things, and very Tower of Babel type stuff. So we're not really sitting down and talking about what we want this to be, like the larger society, like the tech bros have a very specific idea. And I just wish we'd have that conversation, but I'm just going to give you a funny example for, you know, for people to like, how much of this is narrative, how much is reality? Like, you know, when that software route happened last week or a couple weeks ago, time is just, I don't even know anymore. You know, it was because theoretically Anthropic came out with this legal and marketing service on the same day. I was talking to someone at a conference, a builder conference, where the attorneys are now making bank because they're suing people that used AI for contracts and they're incorrect. And in fact, I was a expert witness on a case where the guy called me in to review. He filed a complaint. He used AI to file the complaint. And I had to go to him and say, this is all patently false. There's not a single iota of evidence of what you claim in this complaint. Well, no, the letter said, and I'm like, bring up the letter. What did the letter actually say? And so there was this moment where his brain is just, you know, and he's told me, because I'm a skeptic. I believe in certain aspects of the technology, but I think the hype is crazy. And so he's like, you're wrong on AI. This was 2 weeks before. And then, you know, basically his entire case was, it was not a single fact was correct in the complaint. Yeah. So I just, you know, we're just not there yet. And I say all the time, you can believe in the technology, not the hype, but we're not having real conversations about it, in my opinion. And what I saw in corporate America is they don't have the gumption, they don't have the stick-to-itiveness, like the, you know, perseverance to actually see any of this through. They give up and they send it offshore. They send it to India. Like they just give up because it's hard work. It's really hard work.
Yeah. You have to, it's not out of the box, like some Jarvis like wizard that can do everything for you. You have to know what you're doing. You have to know what models do what specific tasks the best.
Right.
And then you have to check the work too.
You got to check it out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what, I mean, my biggest worry talking about tinfoil hat, like conspiracy, like tying the Epstein files into this, I worry about like a Hegelian dialectic situation being put forth where everybody's like, look, it's all corrupt. The Epstein files are proving this. We need a solution. And then the transhumanist tech bros come in and be like AI. And we get to Minority Report, you know, and that's the solution. Yeah. Everybody welcomes it with open arms because they point at the Epstein files and say this is abhorrent, which obviously objectively it is, but they get that's how you get the Antichrist and the fake solution.
No, I mean, I worry about that too, and I worry that, you know, we are, the noise out there is so massive right now. You know, it's just like dial a conspiracy, and I don't mean like conspiracy like that. It's, I think we can all realize now that the people that were called conspiracy theorists were just the ones paying attention, you know? Right. Yeah, exactly. And so but just the amount of information we're getting, like it's just like, it's, there's a good theory out there for everybody right now to kind of keep them distracted. And I honestly think that's to keep them distracted from what's going on in the economy.
Yeah. Sovereign Individual predicted this in the 90s, the noise to signal ratio is going to go so out of sync. It's impossible to discern unless you have your facilities about you and are your faculties about you and are able to actually take the time to filter the signal through the noise.
Yeah.
What, bringing this back to housing before we get too far down the transhumanist techno rabbit hole. I mean, the demo of this podcast is interesting. It's a bunch of people older than me. Our core demo is older than me. And so basically with what you're seeing in the real estate market, our demo is like older millennials, Gen X and boomers. What would your advice to them be, particularly the older generations that are sitting on a bunch of real estate and trying to think about what to do?
I think you have to list it. I mean, just go ahead and list it. And just, you know, if you think that you're going to be selling in the next couple of years or want to sell, I think you should go ahead and get it listed, because I think all of a sudden at once, you're going to be in the middle of a fire sale. And, you know, it'll come later to certain places and sooner to other places. And that's what I really try to talk about. But, you know, just list it and get a more realistic expectation of what your house is probably worth. And to people that can afford it, I say, go get an independent appraisal, not to do with any loan or anything like that, but just pay for an actual independent appraisal. Because that Zestimate is lying to you. It's not based in reality. It's not a helpful comparison. And so it's done a lot of disservice for people, you know? So if you have real estate, you think you're going to sell in the next, you know, 2 to 5 years, you may want to consider listing it or getting a real appraisal. And then, you know, I would say for those that want to buy, like, you know, if you're aggressive, there are deals, even now out there, but it takes homework. And I think that, you know, during COVID, we all got used to, you know, not doing a lot of work for things. And so you have to be aggressive. But yeah, you know, to me, what's going to happen here because of the silver tsunami is housing is going to become boring again, and it's going to correct to a point where it correlates to the median income, you know. And they've subsidized this market to death. Like they have literally, you know, so people talk about, oh, what about this new bill that just got passed? It's like, it's just more of the same. And most people could get $25,000 in assistance for down payment in their city, like all over the country already. And so they've brought in everybody they can into the mortgage market. I mean, it's just dead. It's dead. Like rates went down massively last week, Marty. I mean, a week and a half ago, purchase applications went down this week. I mean, refi went up, but not purchase. So rates aren't going to do it. We are certainly not seeing rising wages. So really there's one option out of this, you know, and that's home prices have to correct. And so if you're banking on that equity for your retirement, you know, don't be the last one out of the door. Like it just, you know, but if you're, this is your first home and you think you're going to be here for the next 20 years and you don't have to worry as much about this kind of stuff. You know, you want to have reserves on hand for sure in case you lose your job. But you know, you've got a different goal. Unfortunately, probably about 40% of the housing market though is speculation, and their goal is, you know, yield and rising home prices and cashing out that equity to keep the party going. So,
I mean, on that last note there, like how's the Airbnb economy, all those Airbnb wizards who emerged in 2021 and 2022, are they tapped out? Have they fire sold yet, or are they still holding on?
So a lot of them are fire selling. You know, what was funny is they made a transition for a little while to like the whole narrative would be, get out of real estate, get into Bitcoin before, you know, we kind of saw that route in April or whatever. But yeah. So they're coming to market, and like in some of the more crazy markets, like Sevierville, Tennessee, like you can see the distress is bad. And they just built these homes that make no sense, you know, for families of 15, you know, that is good. It's just not. And then places like San Diego, you know, it's just a full on infestation. And so in Austin and all, so they're coming to market. And I think they'll start, you know, as we can continue to see kind of persistent downturns in travel and that kind of thing, that that's just going to accelerate. Because these things aren't making money and they're a headache. I mean, being a landlord is a headache. And Airbnb doesn't care about you at all. Like they treat you like dirt. So they're coming and you're seeing these like motivated seller. And I mean, and you're just seeing crazy, crazy homes that should have never been built come to market in these vacation spots. So.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Airbnb we stayed in when we visited Austin when we were looking for a house in 2021. And I don't think you could ever sell that to somebody who would actually like want to live in that as their residential property.
Did it have a theme?
It did. It did.
My favorite is the bananas theme in Nashville, that property. That, like, there's so many of them, though. Like, there's the Barbie castle. I mean, there's so many themed Airbnbs.
I mean, it's just, I think all this is just an indictment of the federal government, the central banks just mm-hmm. printing money. Like you become deluded into believing that a banana themed Airbnb is a good idea.
Right.
Something right. sustainable as a business.
Right. Right. And I agree. I totally agree. And I just, what's crazy is, and you know, the other thing though, I try to remind myself is when I just go out into the world, and I interview people on the road or Uber driver or whatever, they are way more aware than FinTwit of what's going on. And so I just kind of try to tell myself, okay, you know, we're dealing with a certain group, select group out there in financial media that is, you know, a lot of them are in the ivory tower of some sort, and they don't really understand what's going on. But the regular Americans do.
Yeah. Yeah, in 2 years of like, oh, it was completely obvious. I just didn't tell you about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, exactly. Yeah. We could have never seen this coming. Okie dokie. I mean, it's just math at the end of the day. I mean, the problem is, you know, most of our data is corrupt, so we can't even get to the real math.
Yeah, is there a fix to that, or is it something we just have to deal with?
I mean, surely, right? Like, you know, this company, Placer AI, can tell you how many cell phones are in any one city at any time. Are you telling me we can't really figure out how many houses we have in this country? I mean, I don't get that. Like, and so this woman I met in Australia did a really interesting study. She used the utilities. She used like the water company to really get true inventory. I've gone to a couple different water boards to try to do that. And it's harder over here than I think over there. But you know, it's just, we need real data. But no, I think that we are in full, they are just shoveling it right now, just shoveling it. Like none of this is true, accurate at all. And so I hope there is I hope that more people start standing up and showing up at their city council meetings and saying they're sick of this and that, and you know, but it's going to be us having to take responsibility, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, it's funny too. Maybe just recognize this. Bitcoin obviously focused heavily on CPI, and I'm guilty of it. I'll put my hand up. I'm guilty of it myself to a certain extent. But like during Biden, you're looking at the inflation rates, and you're like, oh, they're underreporting because mm-hmm. they're trying to mask inflation, and now. With Trump, inflation rates coming down, everybody's like, look, it's working. It's like, well, mm-hmm. if the metric was manipulated under the right. prior administration, what's to make you believe right. that it's not manipulated under this one?
Right. Right.
What can you believe? What can we believe these days?
I think what you see, you know, and even then, like, that's kind of funny. I remember after Helene people would argue with me about something I'm reporting on that I saw it right in front of my face, and they're telling me I didn't see that, you know, like, but I did, you know, and I have a picture of it, but it's still. So, I mean, I think that we're at a point where it's just, it's what we can see and then sort of triangulate the data. I mean, I think that that's what I really try to do is like, okay, this picture in front of us doesn't make sense. So how can we put one together, like from the outside, like frame a picture of what's actually happening? And I think when you can do that, when you can kind of triangulate the data and then you can verify it by what you see with your own eyes, I think that's how we, you know, can sort of believe something's true.
Yeah. Look out for the BTFP program for the, private equity guys in their houses. I think that'll be it's a sly round about bailout.
I 100%. I think the same about the Trump homes. That's a builder bailout right there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to buy them at a certain percent of, you know, a median, like adjusted gross income. Like they'll say, okay, you need this to come, I'll buy it from you 25% less. They'll put some price floor on it actually for these builders. And that is a bailout. But, you know, these things tend to, once they get going, there's, you know, they can try and stop them. But the market force just takes over. Yeah.
Well, we'll be observing. We'll be watching. We'll be reading your newsletter to follow along.
Well,
hopefully we can catch up on this at some point later this year.
Absolutely. It's going to be an interesting spring.
It really is. Melody, thank you so much. Everybody, make sure you go subscribe. M3_Melody on Substack. We'll link to that in the show notes. And we'll do this again at some point later this year.
Thank you so much, Marty. Thank you.
Peace and love, freaks. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free. Helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.